go. Thank you, Spider.
Hey, Spider, that fucking bandage on your foot is bigger than your fucking head, you know that?
Come on, Jimmy.
Thank you,
next thing you know, he's gonna be coming in one of these fucking walkers.
Like just on guns.
Even though you got that, you could dance, huh? Give us a little, give us a couple of fucking steps here, Spider. You fucking bullshit of you. Tell the truth, you're looking for sympathy. Is that it, sweetie?
Why don't you go fuck yourself, Tommy?
Oh, that is fucking
I can't believe what I just heard.
Hey, Spider, here. Yeah, this is for you. Attaboy.
I got respect for this. He's got a lot of fucking balls.
Good for you. Don't take no shit off nobody.
He shoots him in the foot. He tells him to go fuck himself.
You're gonna let him get away with that?
You're gonna let this fucking punk get away with that? What's the matter? What's the world coming to?
What the fucking world is coming to? How do you like that?
Hey everybody, this is Adam Shartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio, and you're listening to episode number 325. Thank you for tuning in. Of course, that opening sequence was from the one of the most beloved American films. Goodfellas is so seminal, it's ridiculous. Everybody that is into, you know, it's Goodfellas, right? And today on this episode, I welcoming the first actor that I've had on this show from that film. Michael Imperioli, Goodfellas, Spider. That was him. And Michael's on the show. He was in the Sopranos. Played, of course, Christopher Moltisanti. Right? Tony Soprano's nephew. Anyway, it's a thrill. I wanted Michael Imperioli on the show since I began. He's one of the handful of New York actors that I've wanted on the show since I started. So it's a thrill. He'll be on first. And then we'll get to the show in just a moment. But first I want to say this episode of Film Wax Radio, it's sponsored by Hell's Half Mile Film and Music Festival. Hell's Half Mile is a wonderful festival. I know I've been to this festival. They love my podcast. I love their festival. That's how it works. So there you go. The festival is located in Bay City, Michigan. Okay, anybody from Michigan knows where Bay City is. Rumor has it, Bay City Rollers arbitrarily pointed at a map and they landed on Bay City and they took their name from that they were not from Bay City, that they're actually not even from the States. But that's apparently where they got their name. But Bay City is a fantastic town, and they have this great festival every September. And here's the deal, folks. If you are a filmmaker and you have a film and you want to submit it to a festival that's going to welcome you, they're going to give you the kind of treatment and respect. You're going to get this kind of level of true enthusiasm and support and respect. Hell's Half Mile. They're having their 11th festival, 11th year, September 22nd through the 25th. By the way, as I mentioned, I've been there before. I was there 2 years ago. My birthday always takes place during this festival. They were so sweet. Do you know I was on the jury? They presented me with a birthday cake. Still, to this day, I'm so pleased and so touched by that gesture. And those people that run that festival are forever in my heart. So I'm going to recommend that. You can actually right now submit your film. For the 2016 season, go to hhmfest.com. And you'll see right there on the homepage, there is a link for submitting your film. And you have a choice, as it turns out, if you are a filmmaker. You have a choice between Without a Box or Film Freeway, in which to submit your film. The early bird deadline is going on now through January 15th, and then the regular deadline will be through March 15th. 2016. And then, of course, the late deadline will be through April the 15th. Whether it's a documentary or a narrative, whether it's a short or a feature, consider submitting your film to the Hell's Half Mile Film and Music Festival. And hey, if you happen to be a musician, no harm in getting in touch with the festival too. And by the way, if you're a musician, while I have your attention, I'm always looking for music. I grab music, you know, that I love, you know, and put it on the show. But I'll be happy to promote you if I like your music. If you're listening and you're a musician, send me over some music. You can do that. Okay, get in touch with me. Go to the filmwaxradio.com website, or if you know a musician. But I was talking about the Hell's Half Mile Film and Music, and they're going to be sponsoring a few episodes coming up. I'm proud. If you have a film festival, by the way, consider it. Look on the map. Bay City, Michigan. It's beautiful there. And in the fall, it is gorgeous. And they'll take good care of you. Thank you very much. Okay, so now on to the show. First up here, Michael Imperioli, he's in a new film. It's called The Wannabe. It's about a young guy. He's loves John Gotti. It takes place back then during the trials of John Gotti. When was that? Like in the 80s or something? Anybody? Direct link to great films like Goodfellas. There's a lineage there. Some of the actors you may recognize also in the film is Nick Sandow, who you may know from Orange is the New Black and many other projects. Michael Imperioli's in the film. Patricia Arquette's in the film. It's a great little movie. Go check it out. It's in theaters right now and on various digital platforms. Then after that, we'll get to Brian Posehn, one of the great comedians in the moment. He was in, back in the day, I was first introduced to him on Mr. Show with David Cross and the great Bob Odenkirk. And even till right now, as you may know, if you're a Netflix subscriber, Bob and Dave have gotten back together with a bunch of new episodes for their new reincarnation. And Brian's on that. Brian was also on the Sarah Silverman Show. Well, he's got a new movie. It's called Uncle Nick, and we'll come back to that in just a little while. And Brian Posehn, fantastic, love it, came on Filmwax Radio. So today we have two performer actors, Michael Imperioli first. You're going to hear about his backstory and his whole trajectory, and then we're going to have on Brian Posehn. So right now, let's get into this first conversation. Michael Imperioli, again, the name of the film is The Wannabe, directed by Nick Sandow as well. Check it out. It's in theaters and on demand right now. And let's go to my conversation with Michael Imperioli.
You know how many big shots are in here?
It's probably 30, 40 grand on the table.
It's your time.
Put all the money in the bank.
Is it just you?
Nice college boy. Don't want to get mixed up in the family business.
No one told you to go rob the Blockbuster. You are on your own.
What is this?
And I'm working out some things that might help out John Sr.
Nobody knows you. Where are you from?
I got something big. Take a walk. I got a drill in the Gotti trial. I swear to God, may strike me dead.
Yes!
One more reaction like that, and you will be removed from this courtroom.
How much?
50K.
50K, we get not guilty?
John Gotti's going to jail. No more five families.
John!
You using it yet?
Do I look like I'm using it
yet? I think I may have something that interests you.
We got the clearance from the tippy top.
We got everything.
Christmas came early.
It's the real deal. It's really nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Michael, I have a list of that of people, like a wish list, and you've been seriously at the top since I started talking about film with him.
Great.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Because you're, you know, a real New Yorker. You were raised in Westchester, right?
Yeah, Mount Vernon. Yeah.
Mount Vernon. Which is barely out of the Bronx.
Yeah.
Just barely out of the city.
On the city limits, yeah. You could take the 2 train to the last stop in the Bronx.
And walk.
241st Street and walk to Mount Vernon. I used to do that. I didn't have money for the Metro North train. Uh-huh. I'd do the long walk to the subway.
Oh, really? Yeah. In retrospect, it's a great little anecdote to have. It gives you a little bit of
credibility. Yeah, Frank, I don't know about credibility. No. Walking to the subway is not. A lot of people do that. It gives you kind of a cultural, geographical framework.
That's true. So we'll get into the film, which is called The Wannabe, which you're a supporting character.
Yeah.
But just fill me in, because I don't know a lot about that period when you were growing up. And were you one of just like always the city was beckoning kind of thing? And were you were always interested in acting? And so you started going to the city for theater classes and that kind
I
of thing?
Just, you know, I started getting interested as a possible professional. And towards the end of high school, I started reading a lot of plays in
Samuel French. Going to the theater book
no,
store?
No, in my school, high school library. I started reading a lot of plays, like Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams and David Mamet and things like that. But I had, my dad was a bus driver in the Bronx, but did community theater. When I was around 14, he started doing it out of the blue. He always loved film, took me to a lot of great films, turned me on to a lot of great films, took me to theater, as did my mom. But then he always had a big love for them when I was 14. So he was, I guess, 39, 40, and he started doing community theater. I did one play when I was about 9 at my elementary school. Robin Givens was in the same play, actually. So that was the first thing I did, but I didn't act again. I mean, it was I enjoyed it, but I never did it again. Towards the end of high school, I started reading a lot of plays. And then I was going to go to college in Albany, State University of New York at Albany, but the night before I was supposed to leave for college, so I was already graduated, it was the end of the summer, bags were packed, I was going up, I had done orientation over the summer, and I decided, backed out of it and decided to go to the Lee Strasberg Theater Institute and study acting.
Method.
Yeah. Because I had heard, I didn't really even know much about it, but I just knew the name. Lee Strasberg had died the year before, but I knew the name as a great acting teacher of people that I liked. So I went to that school for a couple of years and studied with a woman from that school, opened her own studio, and was with her for a few years.
Who's that?
Her name was Elaine Aiken. She's passed away a number of years ago, but she was a real big influence in my life, one of the first big ones. Really kind of helped, give me a sense of being an artist and what that meant and what you needed to do to be an artist. And she said, you know, you don't have to go to college, but if you don't go to college, you have to educate yourself as an artist. You have to learn about painting and literature and music and, you know, read good books. And she took us to museums, me and a couple of other students. Actually, one of the actors in The Wannabe is an actor named John Ventimiglia, who was on The Sopranos as Artie Bucco. Johnny was in... I met Johnny when I was 17 at Strasberg, and then he was with Elaine Aiken.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
he's... of course, everybody knows who.
So that's how I started.
Oh, very good.
That was the beginning for me.
What a tradition to start in, like, you know... And can you imagine, like, what year it was? Or was that remotely?
1983.
So only maybe... A handful of years later, then, you were already acting with Robert De Niro. It's kind of shocking to think six years later.
Yeah.
That's remarkable. Can you imagine? Because you had to be one of those guys, right, that you know.
Oh, of course.
You were taking method acting.
Of course.
And he was at just during that period of the height, coming out of King of Comedy and then Raging Bull the remake of
Cape Fear.
Thanks. Oh. Yeah. So I mean, just coming out of this incredible phase, and you were, and then you're in a Goodfellas. Pretty amazing.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It was a big deal for me.
We don't have enough time, obviously, to get into that period of time where you're just kind of coming up. I mean, obviously, that was a major opportunity for you as a young actor.
Yeah. Right? I just started the year before. I just started doing some really small things in movies. Lean on Me was the first movie I was ever in. Morgan Freeman.
Yeah, yeah.
I had one line that got cut because I was so terrible and terrified. But that was and that was the year. It was 1988. That was the year before, and the year before that, I did my first play, which was an off Broadway play that was written by Bobby Moresco, who won the Oscar for Crash. screenplay.
The
or $1 million. I think he wrote Crash and $1 Million
Oh,
Baby.
So he worked with Paul.
He works with Paul Haggis Paul now. Haggis. But I did a play that Bobby
Paul
wrote.
Haggis directed both of those, right? No, Paul Haggis. I thought he directed.
Clint directed.
He wrote. $1 Million Baby.
Yeah, yeah. They were writing partners. Bobby right. Maresco. Okay. Bobby Maresco. The first professional job was a play that Bobby Maresco wrote.
Wow.
It was in Hell's Kitchen. It was kind of based on some of his life, actually. Yeah.
I grew up in this city. Also, maybe a couple years before, maybe even before you, and I don't know. And my parents were members of the public theater, so even though I wasn't really an actor, although I thought about it, but my parents were members of the, like, PAP theater when I was a kid. They would drag me to these plays in the, you know.
Yeah, the good stuff down there.
Back in the 70s, like, you know, and I didn't want to be anywhere near there. It was so disturbing to a kid to see, like, Short Eyes.
Yeah.
And, like, a David Rabe and, you know, all those incredible playwrights that were, you know, creating these incredible plays at the time. But it definitely had an impact on me as well. So what's interesting kind of about The Wannabe, which, by the way, opens on demand and in theaters on December 4th, this Friday, is that there is a kind of a through line, I mean, in some ways, to some of those earlier films, like I was thinking Goodfellas, and some of those De Niro films.
Mean Streets has that kind of flavor.
It does. It has, well, it's for sure, right? But also I was thinking about this guy who is the lead actor in the Vincent, is it Vincent?
Vincent Piazza.
Piazza?
Yeah.
Who's like a, you know, a young guy with dreams of becoming kind of a mobster. But he has a very kind of, you know, sort of fantasy, rich fantasy around it.
Yeah, delusions.
Delusions.
Of grandeur. And,
right.
Yeah,
that he already sort of is somewhat on the inside and that, you know, he has relationships, but he's kind of always on the outside, really looking in.
He's way on the outside. You think he's close to it? He grew up in neighborhoods that are... where there's mobsters and a mob presence, but he was never on the inside.
No, I understand that, right. He was sort of always kind of on the outside looking in, but also had just this, his fantasy world is a little bit dangerous, because obviously ultimately it's a very big danger.
Yeah.
But what I was thinking, no, in a way, that character reminded me of those early De Niro roles, like we mentioned before, like a Rupert Pupkin and a Travis Bickle, because, you know, they lived in a world of fantasy as well, or, you know, some sort of dangerous alternative reality.
Yeah, and there's an obsession with, I mean, in Pupkin's case and also in Travis Bickle's case, there's an obsession with kind of fame.
Yeah.
And
by osmosis, by association.
And in his case, Thomas is the character, the name of the character. Thomas's case, it's an obsession with infamy, really.
Yeah.
But it's kind of the same thing. It's just a more illegal version of fame, you know.
Yeah. So what was your relationship to the film production, and how did you end up taking this role?
So Nick Sandow, who's a writer and director and also plays a role in the movie as the brother of Patricia Arquette. Nick is a longtime friend and collaborator. My wife and I had an off-Broadway theater in New York City for a number of years called Studio Dante. And Nick was one of our main directors.
Oh, very good. Is that, by the way, now longer?
No, there. So he directed, I think, five or six plays with us, two of which I was in. I directed him in two of our plays there. I directed a film in 2008 that he starred in. And we've been just friends and done a lot of things together over the years. Done a lot of other films with other New York directors, and we're actually shooting a movie in Lisbon in February with a director that both of us have worked with in the past several times. So we have a long history.
Oh, yeah? So you're going to be in Portugal in a couple of...
Yeah.
That's nice.
February.
Is it warmer over there?
Is what?
I'm wondering what the temperature is.
It's not as cold as New York. No. It's a lot more mild than New York City.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. And so you had, I think, one scene, if memory serves, with Patricia?
One scene with Vincent, one scene with both of them. Yeah.
Right.
And I did a movie with Patricia in 2012 in Europe, in Germany and Luxembourg, a German production that I don't think ever was released in the States, called My Friend. I can't even remember the name.
That's where the editing is, saying.
My Friend. I can't. I'm spacing.
My Friend Gunther, maybe?
Something like that. I'll remember at some point during this interview, I hope. But, yeah, so I know her. I worked with her and spent some time with her in Europe and got to know her a bit. I was really excited that Nick had cast her in this because I think she's one of the best.
And she's, of course, since got an Oscar. That can't hurt.
Since then. My friend Vijay. That's the name
good,
of the
good, I'm glad you got it. Did you see Boyhood?
No.
Oh, you haven't gotten a chance to see it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think she's wonderful. Yeah. She's a great actress.
She is. And, she, you know, it's great to see her in a role like that, too. You know,
yeah.
Kinda, yeah. And, okay, there's another question about this one other unusual aspect of this. And it's going to be here in New York, I assume. Is it
Friday,
playing,
yeah.
Yeah, and is it playing in L.A. too? Do you know?
Yeah.
I can ask.
It's going to play in a bunch of cities in the U.S. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, that's good. So it's great that this is it's you. You're billed with Vincent and Patricia and you. And there's a couple of other really great character actors in this movie, too. John's in it, as you mentioned.
Dominic Lombardozzi.
Yeah.
Was really good. He was on Boardwalk Empire and among other things.
Executive produced by Martin Scorsese.
Martin Scorsese, executive producer. Yeah, Vincent Piazza, who was on Boardwalk Empire, brought it to his attention, and he read it and loved it and decided to help them out.
Putting his name on it, yeah. It's a big help.
Give him some... I think he was... came in the editing process and gave some notes and advice, but really was much more of a shepherd godfather to it, you know, and just, you know, see it, you know, to see it to completion, you know, and gave Nick, I think, a lot of support.
When you do a show like The Sopranos, I'm sure you get asked this, which was such a, you know, phenomena, and, you know, I just have memories when I was married, sitting with my then wife. And probably we broke up because The Sopranos ended, is my guess. We just remember getting the discs or the tapes. Or I think we started watching it on tape, actually, and getting them in. And then, you know, of course, binge watch. It was the first time I had the opportunity to binge because, you know, we would get the collection in.
Right.
And then, you know, just not be able to, okay, one more episode and then we'll go to bed. Just one more episode. But after doing a show like that, do you have, like, well, first of all, concerns that will be possibly the thing you're best known for one thing. Well, you're relatively young in your career-wise, anyway. Maybe, you know, young to middle-aged in your career.
Middle-aged, okay. Period.
For the career, not maybe in the
world. For the career, yeah, yeah. I guess, yeah.
You got lots of,
hopefully,
many, many years
we'll
and roles ahead of you, I'm sure. And quality-wise, you know, like that kind of... as an actor, where I guess what's that like is really the question.
Well, it'll probably be the thing I'm most known for because it was beloved and very successful and kind of seminal in its influence on television and if you're going to be remembered for something, that's, you know, I'm
damn
very proud of it,
yeah.
And you know, stand by it. As far as like career after, you know, choices after that, you can't make choices trying to repeat a success or top a success or do something
maybe,
for success.
Too.
You have to choose things on their own merit and if it's an interesting character.
Yeah.
I mean, television is, from, you know, I guess everyone thinks, I think an actor chooses roles because they think it's going to be a hit. And it's not the case. You choose a TV show pilot because you think it's good. Yes, it may go a number of years and you have to decide if you're willing to hold that out. But a year on a TV show is a great gig for an actor. People think it's a failure because you do a year and it doesn't get renewed. You only did 1 year. That show was a failure. It's not really a failure. A year of television for an actor is a great gig.
Sure. Because it means now you have a little freedom, right?
It's just a year of work.
Yeah.
You know, and not every show maybe should go more than a year. Not every show should go 5 years. And that's a good gig. So... you have to take each job on its own individual merit and not try to say, well, this looks like it's going to be as big as a soprano, so I'm going to take that because I need to. You can't look at things like that because you have to just, you know, do stuff that you like, that you think find interesting and work really hard. And that's it, really. You know, you go from, you know, job to job. That's the actor's life. I mean, fortunately, I was the longest job I had was the Sopranos, which was great. But I may not do another job that stays that long on the air. And if I don't, it's fine as long as I keep working.
Yeah. Well, I have a feeling you will. But how did that come about?
The Sopranos?
Yeah.
The casting, people, Sheila Jaffe and Jerjan Walken, who I love very much and who are wonderful casting people. I had done several movies with them, mostly independents, before The Sopranos for a number of years. So anything I was remotely right for, they'd always bring me in on.
What was your original book? Did you read some?
I read an episode or two.
Okay.
So I read the pilot, and the pilot, you know, I had never done a television series. I had only done theater and film. So when you do theater or film, you read the script and you decide if you want to do it. When you do television, you read one script and decide if you want to do 80 of them possibly. So it was a very, you have really, you're only looking at a very small slice of it. And usually the pilot's never the best episodes anyway.
Nothing's really developed yet. Had a chance to breathe.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting. I wasn't sure how much of it was a spoof. Was it a dark comedy? Or I really didn't know David. I didn't know the tone of it. So, but I liked a lot of scenes in it. I thought were very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked a lot of the people who were starting to get cast, like Lorraine Bracco, who I'd known a bit. Edie Falco, who I knew pretty well.
Oh, was sure, a good from friend. Theater, right?
Yeah, I had done a pilot with Edie and knew her from, you know, New York.
Yeah.
And Vincent Pastore I had worked with, and Tony Sirico. I didn't know Jim Gandolfini, and I didn't know his work, but I had heard good things about him. And that's how that happened.
The whole idea, the premise of, you know, a mobster, which was really a family man first before being this, you know, the tough guy. I mean, well, it was pretty hybrid, you know, his character, I have to say. But I don't remember before really where, you know, not only that, he was going with, you know, the therapist. You mentioned Lorraine Brock. He was going to a therapist. So it was like the first time this guy was like, could have been your neighbor for real. I mean, I grew up in Queens where actually they were my neighbors, but, you know, somebody right. like that. So that right. he actually did remind me of somebody right. real. And there, that whole community,
right.
you know, bringing home, the going to get in the paper and, you know, eating bagels.
Yeah. And they, and David Chase and Jim, you know, I mean, as well as everyone else who collaborated on books, particularly David Chase and Jim really threaded the needle and were able to kind of walk that fine line between making him likable and relatable and making him very dangerous and scary.
Yeah.
It's not easy to do those two things at once.
Yeah. I remember also seeing those ads before I started watching it and just, what is this show? And, of course, what was the actress's? I don't know. I'm blanking, even though I remember her from growing up, also being on Lou Grant.
Nancy Marchand.
Nancy Marchand. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. What what I miss her. She was
cast.
What a great actress.
It's a very deep, deep cast, you know.
Yeah.
Deep bench, you know.
Like such
you know, a lot of good, really good performers on the show.
Yeah, it brings back some memories. Yeah. Great. Again, the name of this current film is called The Wannabe.
The Wannabe, yeah.
And it's opening this Friday in theaters and on demand, probably iTunes, I'm guessing. And so, you mentioned this project in Lisbon coming up for one thing.
Oh, I'm doing a movie called Cabaret Maxime by this Portuguese filmmaker Bruno de Almeida.
Do you know what else he made? Because I see a lot of international
films. I've done
films.
A bunch of movies with him.
Oh, yeah?
I did a movie called Lovebirds with him. I did a movie called On the Run. Nick Sandow was in both of those.
Okay. Nick Sandow. We'll have to get him on the podcast too eventually.
You should. And In October, I wrapped the first season of a new series for Amazon called Mad Dogs with the leads of myself, Steve Zahn, Ben Chaplin, and Romany Malco. It's, Sean Ryan is the showrunner who created The Shield. A guy named Chris Cole is the creator-writer. Actually, they did a British version of this show, and this is a U.S. version that's premiering on Amazon January. First season.
Oh, fantastic.
I think you could still watch the pilot because we make the pilot last year and then they air the pilot last January and then you decide, they make their decision based
they
on feedback.
You
they
mean
air
like
the pilot
online,
on its own.
Or just like
on Amazon Prime. That's how this streams. They air all their pilots and then they decide if they want to do a season.
It's such a strange way of...
Very different model.
Different, I say strange, but it's, of course, it could be like the way everything's done in a matter of years.
Yeah, well, they don't, you know, because they don't pick up all of them.
And right.
Very
sure.
different than traditional network when if the pilot doesn't get picked up, nobody sees it.
I'm sorry. Is it a, like, packaged as also a standalone, maybe, you know, movie?
No.
Okay.
Series.
But as a, no, I only ask because if they never do, you know, develop it into a series, I wonder if it works on its own.
No.
Or, okay. No. It's interesting.
It's only an hour, first of all, and the ending of our pilot is really where the story begins.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
You know, you mentioned before that the showrunner for this Amazon series, just in passing, and it made me think about how, unless I'm mistaken, because first of all, The Sopranos really was, in my memory, and I could of course be wrong, but it's the what I remember is sort of maybe, if not the first show series, right at the beginning of what they now call the Golden Age, right? So it was David Chase who really was kind of, with the exception maybe of Law and Order, you know, but that it seemed like David Chase was the first star.
Star showrunner.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
For that type of show, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, TV's a writer's medium.
Right.
More than anything, yes. I think. Yeah. Whereas film is more of a director's medium. But,
definitely.
But yeah, usually I would say Dave was the first. David was the first.
And you directed a film a number of years
ago. I directed a film called The Hungry Ghost that Nick Sandow and Steve Sciarrippa star as Emery Cohen, who's now in that movie Brooklyn. He starred in that movie.
Uh-huh.
I think that might have been his first movie, actually.
Is that something you have any hankering to do again?
To direct another movie? Not right now. No, I don't have a story. I mean, I directed that because I just had a story that I really had wanted to tell.
And you wanted to do it. Yeah.
And I wanted to direct. I mean, I've done... that was the only film I directed. I wrote a few screenplays, one of which got produced and directed by Spike Lee. And I wrote a few of the Soprano episodes. But yeah, no, I mean, I don't want to direct for the sake of directing. More if I have a story that I feel needs to get told and only I could do it, then I would do it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And I hope we can do it again, you know.
We'd love to.
Okay,
maybe for Mad Dogs.
Absolutely. You can see Uncle Nick, this featured comedy drama with Brian Posehn, right now on various digital platforms. It might be playing in a theater near you right now. It's a Christmas comedy in the great tradition of the latter-day Christmas comedy dramas. There's the nice, optimistic ones, and then there's these. They're kind of darker. They're more cynical. But they're still at the end about positive things, and this is a great example of that. Uncle Nick... And, of course, Brian Posehn plays Nick, is such an example. And there's a nice cast here, including Missy Pyle, Paget Brewster, Scott Adsit, and Bo Ballinger. And it is directed by Chris Kasich, and it's currently out there. So I urge you to check out Uncle Nick. You can watch it on Vimeo On Demand, by the way, for a very reasonable price. Go check out Uncle Nick with a very, very funny Brian Posehn. And here we go with my conversation with Brian.
Hey, Valerie. What's crack-a-lackin', girl?
Merry Christmas. Santa's here.
It's hard to believe you're my uncle. You're sort of like a weird homeless dude who just kind of wandered in here.
Well, believe it. My brother married your mom.
We're family now. Hey, Doc, can you sell me some Vicodin?
There's a difference between pharmaceutical sales and being a doctor.
How about a little Viagra for a buddy?
Just keep it together, okay? It's our first real Christmas.
Perfect. So it's called Film Wax Radio, the show. It's really conversational.
Okay.
It's not so. You must have done quite a few of these. Podcast types.
Not yet. No, no.
Not well, just for
Marins.
The film. But
oh, yeah.
Oh, you did Marins.
Yeah,
you did.
I don't do very many. I don't love talking about myself till I have to, so when I'm promoting stuff, but like the friends that just go, hey, you want to do my thing? Nope, I don't. So I've done like Nerdist over the years,
right.
Mark Maron, just the main comedy ones.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I'm in a town, some guy has his own... you know.
And chances are, Simpsons. Chances are, they do.
Yeah.
And
all the
whatever,
time.
Every town.
Yeah. So I just say no every time.
Also, just so you have a little context, as if you're asking for it, I try to come across as someone who's championing film and also talk about things that are going on in the independent film world. Cool. And, you know, so a lot of my guests are actually people like distributors, too.
Nice.
I might have a programmer, journalist. You know, I mix it up. And so hopefully, like, having somebody on like yourself helps kind of make it an entertaining show.
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll see. Yeah, exactly. Jury's out on that. It's okay. I can start doing.
Try to be
I can start doing impressions. I was trying to do you before for somebody.
Oh, man.
One of the things that distinguishes you, I think, is your voice. It's just,
yes.
It does not come as a shock to you, right?
No.
So anyway, Brian Posehn, just watched the Aziz Ansari show. That must have been fun for you to do.
Oh, that's Eric Wareheim.
I know. I'm kidding. It was part of my. I meant to do it.
It took me a minute because I haven't seen it. I haven't watched it. But I am aware that Eric's in it and that people do think I look like him.
It's so funny because I'm so obviously an idiot. Because not that I made the mistake, that was going to be intentional. But I was going to wait till you knew me a little bit better and could trust me before I said that so you understood where it's coming from. Because I was going to say at the end, and, you know, how is it working with Tim? And you know, because I imagine as two Hulk. Tall, funny.
I have worked with those guys, so yeah. But I'm not Eric Wareheim. I played him on one episode, I think.
I
think I did one where I replaced him.
That's so funny. That's really funny.
Of their second show, you know, because I did Gibbons on their first show on Tom Goes to the Mayor. And then I wound up doing another thing on the other one, Tim and Eric's, whatever they called it.
Yeah. And it's funny because I also just watched The Comedy again for like the fourth time, which is one of my favorite.
The which one?
The Comedy, you know, Rick Alverson's film where Eric's in it. He's like, and this ironic, you know, I did this podcast, the last one I'll ever do because this asshole ended up talking about Eric Wareheim the entire time. anyway, you have to see The Comedy.
You were doing an impression of me talking to somebody else after this?
That was it, yeah. No, it was like you have to see The Comedy. I think you'd love it. First of all,
I like comedy.
The comedy itself.
No, I don't watch much comedy.
Well, this is not even a comedy.
Oh, it's not. Okay.
It's sort of, well, it has incredible funny moments in it, but it's really not. It's an ironic title. And Tim is the star of it.
It's an indie movie that he did?
I'll get these guys a link or something. I'll just so you know what the context of it. But anyway, now I feel very, very motivated to talk about Uncle Nick because we've wasted a lot of time not talking about Uncle Nick. But I do have a lot of curiosity about your career also, and I know Sarah Silverman show, obviously, which is definitely how my introduction to you.
Okay, cool.
And which I loved. And nice. I loved your characters. I loved your character on that show. And I was just like, who is that guy? And just to know a couple of years later that I'd be talking to you is a thrill.
So, nice.
Yeah. Uncle Nick, so did you make a concerted effort to go in a new direction? Because it's obviously, this is a comedy drama, but it's mostly... It's you in a very different light.
Yeah, there's both. I mean, I feel like it's similar to characters I've played. It's just more layered. There's just more to it. I mean, and it wasn't like I made it an effort to do it, but as an actor and a performer, I was waiting for something like this, honestly. Yeah, I've been waiting for somebody to go, hey, we should have him be the main guy in something. You know, it's never happened. I'm always, you know, smaller walk-ons, and then, you know, with Sarah, I was part of the main cast. But I wasn't Sarah, you know, I was Brian.
Yes.
And so, yeah, it was one of those things I was waiting. And when I have friends that have gotten lead parts, you know, that I'm never jealous. I'm not that kind of guy. But there was definitely like, oh, that's cool. And that would be cool if that ever landed in my lap. And then when Uncle Nick, the script came to me. I hate myself so much, and I'm such an idiot sometimes, that I didn't even read it right away. You know, I was told that this was a thing for me, and then I went, well, that can't be good, you know, even though I was waiting for it. And then finally it took a buddy of mine who had read the script. He said, dude, you know, quit being an idiot. Read the thing. You're going to really dig it. These guys wrote it for you. They're waiting to hear what you think of it. And then finally I read it and loved it right away. But
It would be completely natural also, by the way, even though it's something that's something you've been craving for, but it would make complete sense also that once it would land in your lap that you would, that then the reality of it would start to kind of weigh in, and yeah. you might start thinking, ooh, now the self-doubt kicks in a little
well,
bit.
Well, then once I signed on, then there was definitely like, oh, man, I'm in every scene. Oh, man, I got to do this. And, without giving things away, there was some things in the script where I was like, how am I going to do that and have people not hate me? You know, because the character is, there's elements to him that are kind of unlikable. I mean, what's the language content on this show? Like,
oh, wide open.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, the main idea.
Not fuck. Oh, don't say that.
Okay, that's what I was about to.
Yeah, don't say fuck.
Okay.
No, you can say it.
I mean, the main idea of this movie is this guy goes to Christmas to try to fuck his step-niece. I mean, that's the main premise of the movie. So
it's a spoiler.
Yeah. No, well, no, I don't. I think you know it by 5 minutes in when
sure.
I'm
no, true.
Trying to buy booze to ply her with. Right. You get the idea. And that's a tough main premise to get around, you know.
Yeah.
I've had other, you know, dudes that kind of are creepy go, hey, that's not that bad going after a 19-year-old. And I'm like, yeah, it's kind of bad, dude, if you're 50.
It depends. If you're talking to Woody Allen, maybe not.
Right. But I had another friend of mine go, I don't think that's creepy. And I'm like, yeah, because that's what you do. But no.
No. The bar has also changed maybe from unfortunately, or whatever, just right. realistically.
And she's not actually related. She's my brother's stepniece, or, stepdaughter, but
oh, right.
still.
Yeah, still. It's Woody Allen technical.
There's some creepiness to it. Yeah, and the way I go about it of I'm going to get her drunk, and then we'll see what happens.
But we do want to say also that Uncle Nick represents kind of like a little bit of a nihilistic lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, like because you drink, smoke, a party, and
kind of like doesn't care what people think about him, really.
Yeah. So she kind of, right, that's probably the most important thing. And she kind of probably craves that herself. So
yeah.
I was wondering if the sketch shows, because also we could have mentioned you were on Mr. Show, and you're involved in the
just Odin did the Kirk, new one with Bob and David.
Which I saw too, which is wonderful stuff. Does that help? Because obviously you're doing a lot of comedy stuff, but I'm thinking the sketch shows might help in some ways develop characters, right? Because, you know, like doing an Uncle Nick, which, you know, I guess is an extension of Brian Posehn, but it's also, it does require you to dig a little deeper in.
Right, right. And well, and for this, I actually did something I'd never done. I hired an acting coach, which you don't need to do when you just walk onto a sitcom and say something stupid and walk out. But for this, I felt like I needed to, you know, and it really helped. Getting somebody to make me go a little deeper and play it real. And, you know, I'd done, the kind of nerdy curmudgeon before, but this is a nerdy curmudgeon with a bunch of levels. So I did help to have somebody else kind of hold my hand and tell me it's okay to do, you know, these things that were kind of foreign to me.
Yeah. What was like the biggest takeaway from the coaching?
Just to trust and play in yourself and play it more real. I mean, I think I went into it going, well, I know these comedic moments. I know I can do those. I know, you know, I have confidence and I trust myself that I can get through that stuff. It's the other, you know, it's the real moments, the telling the story. You know, I have this story of my ex and how, you know.
Yeah, right. That's,
it's kind of tragic. Right. And I've never done anything like that on camera. So, yeah. I had to go a little real, and I played off real moments. You know, I have a little boy, so whenever I had to think of tragedy, I would just think of the idea of losing him, which as a parent is the worst thing. So that helped me get through these other things that I didn't really have a connection to. I've never, you know, never had a girlfriend die, but Uncle Nick has.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Right. He lives alone in a house. And oh, by the way, we should mention Cleveland is a character in the
yes,
book.
Definitely.
And I also have a really nicely written and spoken framing device, which you set up, which is this well-known Cleveland Indians game.
Not if you're not a sports nerd. I had never heard of it, but it's the big 10-cent beer night. That's what it was, right? In the 70s.
It really was a 10-cent beer night, right?
Yeah. And that,
which back in the 70s probably was like a buck now or something.
Right, and caused this riot against the Rangers. They were playing the Rangers. I think it's early, maybe 1970 was when it happened. I'm not sure.
But it's nice to break up the film, too, in a way, like, obviously among the innings, you know, because you kind of interrupt.
And it parallels the story.
Right. And of course, the ultimate complete and utter chaos that this Christmas.
Yes. Because the film. I caused a little chaos.
Yeah. There's somebody else who causes some chaos.
Right.
But we should also mention the film takes place over the course of one day, which is Christmas Eve day, right through Christmas Eve and overnight, I guess, epilogue. And what goes on with his family during the course of that time. And then again, it's framed with this famous game. And it also is almost like a mini little short film itself.
Well, yeah, our director has done documentaries and the fact that Chris Kasich directed it.
So he has a documentary background.
Yeah, and then he'd worked with Errol Morris, and Errol Morris came on as a producer after we had already shot the thing.
That's usually what executive producers do, right? They wait and see.
Yeah, he came on after he saw a cut of it and enjoyed it and liked, you know, obviously the documentary element, but also liked the comedy and kind of where it goes.
Yeah, right. The director of Thin Blue Line.
Yeah.
And,
you don't see him, in your head, you're like, produced a Christmas comedy?
That was not necessarily my question. And then the publicist just told me that he was a protege or a, you know, right?
Yeah.
Like,
Kasich Morris was, yes.
Yeah, what I meant. And so he worked for Errol Morris at one point or other, right? Which would
So that's the connection.
And it's really nice that Morris came on as executive producer. He certainly comes on, he's executive produced those two, you know, documentaries made by Joshua Oppenheimer, the Act of Killing and the Look of Silence, which are pretty tragic stories shot in in Indonesia. But this is a little different.
Cleveland, Indonesia.
Yeah. So did you grow up in Cleveland?
I'm Northern California.
You are?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I was wondering, because you just sort of also, it goes to your acting.
People buy the Midwest thing from me. I don't know. I've been there. But
okay. Who wouldn't? Why would anybody not believe if you said it? But you've been there. Well, I know. I actually have family in Cleveland, so I've been there.
And, nice.
I always thought I had the nicest time in Cleveland. Of all the cities, you know, I've been to in Cleveland, there haven't been that many. I've had a good time in Cleveland. So I don't look at it as a mistake on the lake, personally.
Right.
And again,
I think people who live there do. Yeah.
Maybe. I haven't suffered through a winter on the lakes. But anyway. And which we should talk about also some of the other
cast.
The cast is in it too. And I know that Missy Pyle, the whole cast kind of came together
because they're all my friends.
And Scott Adsit, who is also obviously he's a regular, like he's pops up in a lot of work you do as well.
Huh? Yeah, well, and it's one of those things. I didn't look at it and went, oh, how do I cast all my friends in this? It just when they were casting, they were having problems finding these people, and I just stepped in. And my wife is a manager and knows all the knows all the comedic talent in L.A. and out here, and she helped too.
She manage?
She manages Scott Adsit, and she manages Ron Funches and a couple other comedians.
Yeah.
So she really helped me out. And Missy was her idea completely.
She's good.
Not even a client.
Yeah.
It's just a friend of ours. And we had tried to cast another friend who I won't name, but she got busy and then pulled out. So we were kind of panicking. It was getting close to shooting. And my wife went, what about Missy Pyle? Like, she's the same size as you. And, female, she's thin and pretty, but she's very tall. And thought that would play. And
genetics.
Yeah, and then the chemistry, once we, I've known her a long time. And then once we sat down and started pretending we're brother and sister, it just came together. I mean, and a lot of the stuff that you see wasn't even in the script. We riffed a lot, or she and I did. They must have a ton of extra footage because we would just go on and on and on until we were told to shut up.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully
or cut.
Yeah. Well, maybe it'll end up on a bonus feature.
But and then the ad sit, that came together of, he'd be great as her husband, And then Padgett, I've known for many, many years. I've probably known Padgett the longest. Well, no, I knew Scott from Mr. Show, and I met her around the same time. So,
and she plays your
My brother's new wife. Cougar wife.
Yeah, I wasn't familiar with her. I'm sure I've seen her in stuff.
She was on Criminal Minds, a drama on CBS for like 5 or 6 years. Okay. And she's been around.
Yeah, I miss a lot of television.
And she does stuff with Paul F. Tompkins all the time. Uh-huh. So that's how I knew her comedic chops, were up there. Because I hadn't really seen her do much funny stuff over the years, but I've known her, and I know she's actually funny.
Does that always translate, though? You might have somebody who's obviously just sort of instinctually funny or unintentionally funny, but...
Right. No, it doesn't. But, yeah, I just trusted that it would. And she's not...
She didn't really have the funny role.
Yeah, she doesn't have the funny stuff. She kind of...
But...
She kind of had a thankless part, but she killed it. She did so well, in my opinion.
But as it's kind of cliche to say the straight man is as hard, if not harder, because your timing, it has to really be, you don't get the audience laughing when you hit the mark. And there aren't those obvious, responses that let you know that. So you really have to just be very good and trust your instincts as a straight person.
Right.
So, working with
a couple of jackasses.
I guess that's the way.
Oh, yeah.
So this would be then definitely something that you want to do more of, right?
Absolutely.
That's great.
Yeah. I'd love to play bigger parts and, happy in my place, but I was also very happy that this came about.
Well, you want to keep evolving, right?
Absolutely.
Who wants to just do the same thing anymore?
But I have so many irons in the fire. I'm doing so many things at once that, acting wasn't my focus, but, I'm more, stand up and writing and everything else and came together.
What else is coming up? I know you just have a lot of pride. What some things take, and then other things sort of spin kind of until they,
Just finished editing last night my new special. So, my new stand up special is called Criminally Posane, and that'll be on Amazon first and then kind of everywhere else after that.
I see. But, is that like an hour?
Yeah, it's an hour. It's my second. I did one a couple years ago for Netflix, and this will wind up on Netflix, but we're starting out at Amazon.
Yeah, they seem to be just...
Everybody does them now, and it's cool to do them in these other places. HBO doesn't do too many a year.
Sure.
It doesn't mean what it used to mean to have an HBO special. That used to be like, you get an HBO special, it doesn't really mean that
prestige
anymore.
Factor.
Now people, my peers do these specials wherever they want, Mm-hmm. So I was kind of inspired by guys like Louie and Aziz who wound up doing them in different places.
And how long did it take for you to develop this hour? I don't know when you did your last special.
So the turnaround for me is over 2 years. It's about, because I'm also doing other things, but I don't completely gut my act when I finish it. I'll start writing new jokes and then I'll rotate the old ones out and put new ones in. And then hopefully by 2 years I have a full hour.
Right.
And that's kind of what happened this last time. The turnaround time is getting shorter for me. I think between my first record and my second record, it was 4 or 5 years, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Or about 4 of actually getting all the material. So I've cut that time in half. I'm down there around 2. So,
where did you perform that special?
This new one was in San Diego at the House of Blues during Comic-Con, which was a good fit.
Yeah, and people are already drunk and...
But they're also ready to hear a nerd talk about being nerdy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, that's what was so lovely about that character on Silverman, right? Because also on the Her Show, right? Weren't you? You were like the ultimate nerd, and
yeah. That character was basically me,
except he was married to a guy.
Was
it tailored to you? I should say.
Yeah.
Because he was also a gay character, which was just sort of like in a way, it was a device. It was here's something you wouldn't expect. These two big kind of nerdy guys happened to also be.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a device, but
well,
it
I
was
mean,
kind of secondary to their characters.
Oh, for sure. And I feel like it was a really well played out. The characters were really well played out.
It was kind of the genius of Sarah. That was all her show. She ran it with other people, but all the ideas were hers. And Steve and I are two of her closest male friends in real life, and she loves us and loves having us around, and kind of, you know, wrote these, not kind of, completely wrote those characters for us. And honestly, we did the pilot and it wasn't spelled out that we were gay. Mm-hmm. And then we did the second episode and I'm reading the script and I call Steve and I go, "Hey, are we gay?" And he's like, "Are you an idiot?" I'm like, "Yeah."
Which
sometimes
part, when you're waking up in the bed together, didn't you understand?
Yeah, that? It was kind of like,
well, you're both kind of big teddy bears, you know.
Yeah,
and it's nice. It was nice.
But I love that she did it that way instead of saying, "Hey, you're going to play a gay guy," and then it's, you know, and then
and
going,
toss your arms around.
Yeah,
when you, talk,
you know, because, what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. Like, no, it was a very positive image, and
yeah,
it was like you say, very secondary to the role. It didn't,
right, and she didn't want. Not that Will and Grace was bad, but she didn't want the typical sitcom gay guy. That's not what she wanted from us.
Right.
You know, she wanted us to basically be ourselves, and then instead of being married to a tiny blonde lady like I am in real life, I'm married to a dude who looks like me.
Yeah. How old's your kid, by the way?
6.
Okay. That's nice. That's great.
It's a fun stage. I'm having a blast.
Yeah. I have an 11-year-old. It's still, it's still fun. Yesterday, he took the... he got home from school on his own for the first time.
Oh, wow.
Because of bad
parents.
That's
a big deal. Oh,
it
somebody
was.
Forgot him?
No. It wasn't quite like that. We had it like just... His mother is an actress. And
okay.
Got caught up at a some sort of thing she had to do. It was she had to do it. I was off doing something artsy, too. And so... He and the babysitter was running late or something like that. So, you know, he knew how to get home and he's almost 12. You know, he could do it. It's just that he ended up, and it was fine. It was perfectly fine without incident. I was just so proud. It's a big deal.
Yeah,
6 years
for
old,
sure.
You can imagine,
yes.
You know, one day him walking, your little boy walking, being old enough to kind of do that. Kind
right.
Of thing.
It scares the shit out of me.
Yeah, a little bit, but I knew he was fine. Well, it was a lot of fun talking.
Yeah, man. Nice talking to you.
Hopefully we'll do it again sometime with other films. Yeah, Uncle Nick is the name of the film, and it stars Brian Posehn at Al, and it's opening, son of a bitch.
It's about 10 or 12 theaters this weekend.
It's opening Friday.
Yeah.
Right, it's opening Friday and around in city near you, and then I'm sure on digital platforms, too.
The same day. It goes to
iTunes.
iTunes, Amazon,
all the big
Direct, I think if you PlayStation, all those places.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I mean,
thanks,
really,
man. Thanks for having me.
I hope it was not... I'm hoping it was up there, Marin...
sure.
Some guy in, you know, Oshkosh.
I never do those. So, yeah. Well, nice.
I feel honored that you did it. It was a lot of fun
cool.
to talk to you. And,
thanks, man.
Perfect. So it's called Film Wax Radio, the show. It's really conversational.
Okay.
It's not so. You must have done quite a few of these podcast types.
Not yet. No, no.
Not
well,
just
I
for
Marin's.
The film. But
yeah.
Oh, you did Marin's.
Yeah,
you did.
I don't do very many. I don't love talking about myself till I have to. So when I'm promoting stuff, but like the friends that just go, "Hey, you want to do my thing?" Nope, I don't. So I've done like... Nerdist over the years,
right.
Mark Maron, just the main comedy ones.
Yeah,
but you know, if I'm in a town, some guy has his own, you know,
and chances are, chances are they do, and
all the
whatever,
time,
every
and
town.
So I just say no every time.
Also, just so you have a little context, as if you're asking for it, I try to come across as someone who's championing film and also talk about things that are going on in the independent film world.
Cool.
And, you know, so a lot of my guests are actually people like distributors, too.
Nice.
I might have a programmer, journalist. You know, I mix it up. And
cool.
So hopefully, like, having somebody on like yourself helps kind of make it an entertaining show.
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll see. Yeah, exactly. Jury's out on that. It's okay. I can start doing.
Try to be entertaining.
I can start doing impressions. I was trying to do you before for somebody.
Oh man!
One of the things that distinguishes you, I think, is your voice. It's just,
yes.
It does not come as a shock to you, right?
No.
So anyway, Brian Posehn, just watched the Aziz Ansari show. That must have been fun for you to do.
Oh, that's Eric Weyerhart.
I know. I'm kidding. It was part of my...
It took me a minute because I haven't seen it. I haven't watched it. But I am aware that Eric's in it and that people do think I look like him.
It's so funny because I'm so obviously an idiot. Because not that I made the mistake. That was going to be intentional. But I was going to wait till you knew me a little bit better and could trust me before I said that so you understood where it's coming from. Because I was going to say at the end, and you know, how is it working with Tim? And you know, because I imagine as two Hulk tall,
I have worked with those guys, so yeah. But I'm not Eric Wareham. I played him on one episode, I think. I think I did one where I replaced him.
That's so funny. That's really funny.
Of their second show, you know, because I did Gibbons on their first show on Tom Goes to the Mayor. And then I wound up doing another thing on the other one, Tim and Eric's, whatever they called it.
Yeah. And it's funny because I also just watched The Comedy again for like the fourth time, which is one of my favorite.
The which one?
The Comedy, you know, Rick Alverson's film where, oh, Eric's in it. He's no. like, and this is ironic. You know, I did this podcast, the last one I'll ever do, because this asshole ended up talking about Eric Wareham the entire time. anyway. You have to see The Comedy.
You were doing an impression of me talking to somebody else after this?
That was it, yeah. But no, it's like you have to see The Comedy. I think you'd love it. First
I don't
of all,
like comedy.
The comedy itself.
No, I don't watch much comedy.
Well, this is not even a comedy.
Oh, it's not. Okay.
It's sort of, well, it has incredible funny moments in it, but it's really not. It's an ironic title. And Tim is the star of it.
It's an indie movie that he did?
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah. But it's, yeah. I'll get these guys a link or something. I'll just so you know what are the context of it. But anyway, now I feel very, very motivated to talk about Uncle Nick because we've wasted a lot of time not talking about Uncle Nick. But I do have a lot of curiosity about your career also. And I know Sarah Silverman Show, obviously, which is definitely how my introduction to you.
Okay, cool.
And which I loved. And nice. I loved your characters. I loved your character on that show. And I was just like, who is that guy? And just to know a couple of years later that I'd be talking to you is a thrill.
So, nice.
Yeah. Uncle Nick, so did you make a concerted effort to go in a new direction? Because it's obviously, this is a comedy drama, but it's mostly, it's you in a very different life.
Yeah, there's both. I mean, I feel like it's similar to characters I've played. It's just more layered. There's just more to it. I mean, and it wasn't like I made an effort to do it, but as an actor and a performer, I was waiting for something like this, honestly. Yeah, I've been waiting for somebody to go, hey, we should have him be the main guy in something. You know, it's never happened. I'm always, you know, smaller walk-ons, and then, you know, with Sarah, I was part of the main cast, but I wasn't Sarah. You know, I was Brian.
Yes.
And so, yeah, it was one of those things I was waiting. And when I have friends that have gotten lead parts, you know, that I'm never jealous. I'm not that kind of guy. But there was definitely like, oh, that's cool. And that would be cool if that ever landed in my lap. And then when Uncle Nick, the script came to me, I hate myself so much, and I'm such an idiot sometimes, that I didn't even read it right away. You know, I was told that this was a thing for me, and then I went, well, that can't be good, you know, even though I was waiting for it. And then finally it took a buddy of mine who had read the script. He said, dude, you know, quit being an idiot. Read the thing. You're going to really dig it. These guys wrote it for you. They're waiting to hear what you think of it. And then finally I read it and loved it right away, but...
It would be completely natural also, by the way, even though it's something that's something you've been craving for, but it would make complete sense also that once it would land in your lap that you would, that then the reality of it would start to kind of weigh in, and you might start thinking, ooh, now the self-doubt kicks in a little
bit. Well, then once I signed on, then there was definitely like, oh, man, I'm in every scene. Oh, man, I got to do this. And, without giving things away, there were some things in the script where I was like, how am I going to do that and have people not hate me? You know, because the character is, there's elements to him that are kind of unlikable. I mean, what's the language content on this show? Like,
oh, wide open.
Okay, so, you know, the main idea.
Not fuck. Oh, don't say that.
Okay, I was about to.
Yeah, don't say fuck.
Okay.
No, you can say it.
I mean, the main idea of this movie is this guy goes to Christmas to try to fuck his step-niece. I mean, that's the main premise of the movie. So
it's a spoiler.
I think you know it by 5 minutes in when trying to buy booze to ply her with.
Right.
You get the idea. And that's a tough main premise to get around, you know.
Yeah.
I've had other, you know, dudes that kind of are creepy go, hey, that's not that bad going after a 19-year-old. And I'm like, yeah, it's kind of bad, dude, if you're 50.
No, it depends. If you're talking to Woody Allen, maybe not.
Right. But I had another friend of mine go, I don't think that's creepy. And I'm like, yeah, because that's what you do. But no.
No. The bar has also changed maybe from, unfortunately, or whatever, just realistically.
And she's not actually related. She's my brother's stepniece or, stepdaughter. But still.
Yeah, still. It's that Woody Allen technical.
There's some creepiness to it. Yeah, and the way I go about it, I'm going to get her drunk. And then we'll see what happens.
But we do want to say also that that Uncle Nick represents kind of like a little bit of a nihilistic lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, like because you drink, smoke, a party. Yeah. And
kind of like doesn't care what people think about him, really.
Yeah. So she kind of, right, that's probably the most important thing. And she kind of probably craves that herself. So.
Yeah.
I was wondering if the sketch shows, because also we could have mentioned you were on Mr. Show, mm-hmm. and you're involved in the
just Odenkirk, did the new one with Bob and David.
Which I saw too. Which is wonderful stuff. Does that help? Because obviously you're doing a lot of comedy stuff, but I'm thinking the sketch shows rather might help in some ways develop characters, right? Because you know, like doing an Uncle Nick, which you know, I guess is an extension of Brian Posehn, but it's also it does require you to dig a little deeper in.
Right, right, and for this I actually. Did something I'd never done. I hired an acting coach, which you don't need to do when you just walk onto a sitcom and say something stupid and walk out. But for this, I felt like I needed to, mm-hmm. you know, and it really helped getting somebody to make me go a little deeper and play it real. And, you know, I'd done, you know, the kind of nerdy curmudgeon before, but this is a nerdy curmudgeon with a bunch of levels. So I did help to have somebody else kind of hold my hand and tell me it's okay to do, you know, these things that were kind of foreign to me.
Yeah. What was, like, the biggest takeaway from the coaching?
Just to trust and play in yourself and play it more real. I mean, I think I went into it going, well, I know these comedic moments. I know I can do those. I know, mm-hmm. you know, I have confidence and I trust myself that I can get through that stuff. It's the other, you know. It's the real moments, the yeah. telling the story. You know, I have this story of my ex and how, you know.
Yeah, right. That's
it's kind of tragic. Right. And I've never done anything like that on camera. So yeah. I had to go a little real, and I played off real moments. You know, I have a little boy. So whenever I had to think of tragedy, I would just think of the idea of losing him, which
yeah.
as a parent is the worst thing. So that helped me get through these other things that I didn't really have a connection to. I've never, you know, never had a girlfriend die, but Uncle Nick has.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Right. He lives alone in a house. And oh, by the way, we should mention Cleveland is a character in the
yes,
book.
Definitely.
And I also have a really nicely written and spoken framing device, which you set up, which is this well-known Cleveland Indians game.
Not if you're not a sports nerd. I had never heard of it. But, yeah, it's the big 10-cent beer night. I mean, that's what it was, right, in the 70s.
It really was a 10-cent beer night, right?
Yeah. And that,
which back in the 70s probably was like a buck now or something.
Right, and caused this riot against the Rangers. They were playing the Rangers. Yeah, I think it's early, maybe 1970 was when it happened. I'm not sure.
But it's nice to break up the film, too, in a way, like, obviously among the innings, you know, because you kind of interrupt.
Right, and it parallels the story. Yeah.
Right, and of course, the ultimate complete and utter chaos that this Christmas.
Yes,
because the film,
I caused
another
a little
thing
chaos. Yeah.
There's somebody else who causes some chaos.
Right.
But we should also mention the film takes place over the course of one day, which is Christmas Eve day,
mm-hmm.
right through Christmas Eve and overnight, I guess, the epilogue. And what goes on with his family during the course of that time. And then again, it's framed with this famous game. And it also is almost like a mini little short film.
Yeah.
Itself.
Well, yeah. The our director has done documentaries, you know, the
Mike
fact that Chris Kasich directed it. But
Chris, so he has a documentary background.
Yeah, and then he'd worked with Errol Morris, and Errol Morris came on as a producer after we had already shot the thing.
That's usually what executive producers do, right? They wait and see.
Yeah, he came on after he saw a cut of it and enjoyed it and liked, you know, the obviously the documentary element, but also liked the comedy and kind of where it goes.
Yeah, right. The director of Thin Blue Line.
Yeah.
And,
you don't see him, you know, in your head. You're like, he produced a Christmas comedy?
Well, Well, that was not necessarily my question, and the publicist just told me that he was a protege or a, you know, right?
Yeah.
Like,
or Kasich
Morris
was, yes.
Yeah, that's, yeah. What, that's what I meant. And so he worked for Errol Morris at one point or other, right? Which would
so that's
definitely
the connection.
And it's
yeah.
really nice that Morris came on as executive producer. He certainly comes on, he's executive produced those two, you know, documentaries made by Joshua Oppenheimer, you know, the Act of Killing and the Look of Silence, which are pretty tragic stories shot in, like, you know, in Indonesia. But,
right.
But this is a little different.
Cleveland, Indonesia.
Yeah. So did you grow up in Cleveland? Or
no, that, no, I'm Northern California.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I was wondering, because you just sort of also, it goes to your acting.
People buy the Midwest thing, you know, from me. I don't know. I've been there. Yeah, but
okay. Who wouldn't?
Been,
I mean,
everywhere.
Why would anybody not believe if you said it? You know, but you've been there. Well, I know. I actually have family in Cleveland, so I've been there. And,
nice.
I always thought I had the nicest time in Cleveland. Of all the cities, you know, I've been to in Cleveland, there haven't been that many.
Even
but
in Ohio,
it's definitely, I've had a good time in Cleveland. So I don't look at it as a mistake on the lake, personally.
Right.
But, and again,
I think people who live there do. Yeah.
Maybe. I haven't suffered through a winter
right.
on the lakes. But anyway. And which we should talk about also some of the other
cast.
The cast is
in
it too. And I know that Missy Pyle.
The whole cast kind of came together because they're all my friends. And
Scott Adsit, who is also obviously he's a regular, like he's pops up in a lot of work you do as well.
Yeah, well, and it's one of those things. I didn't look at it and went, oh, how do I cast all my friends in this? It just when they were casting, they were having problems finding these people, and I just stepped in. And my wife is a manager and knows all the comedic talent in L.A. and out here, and she helped too. And,
what does she manage?
She manages Scott Adsit, and she manages Ron Funches and a couple other comedians.
Yeah.
So she really helped me out. And Missy was her idea completely.
She's good.
Not even a client.
Yeah.
It's just a friend of ours. And we had tried to cast another friend who I won't name, but she got busy and then pulled out. And then so we were kind of panicking. It was getting close to shooting. And my wife went, what about Missy Pyle? Like, she's the same size as you. And, you know, or, you know, the female, you know, she's thin and pretty, but she's very tall. And thought that would play. And
You get away with the genetics.
Yeah, and then the chemistry, once we, you know, I've known her a long time, and then once we sat down and started pretending we're brother and sister, it just came together. I mean, and a lot of the stuff that you see wasn't even in the script. We riffed a lot, or she and I did. And then, I mean, they must have a ton of extra footage because we would just go on and on and on until we were told to shut up.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully
or cut.
Yeah. Well, maybe it'll end up on a
right.
bonus feature.
But and then the Adsit, you know, that came together of, oh, he'd be great as her husband, you know. And then Padgett, I've known for many, many years. I've probably known Padgett the longest. Well, no, I knew Scott from Mr. Show, and I met her around the same time. So.
And she plays the your
my brother's,
new wife.
Cougar wife.
I wasn't familiar with her. I'm sure I've seen her in stuff.
She was on Criminal Minds, you know, a drama on CBS for like 5 or 6 years.
Okay.
And she's been around.
Yeah, I miss a lot of television.
And she does stuff with Paul F. Tompkins all the time.
Uh-huh.
So that's how I knew her comedic chops, you know, were up there. Because I hadn't really seen her do much funny stuff over the years. But I've known her, and I know she's actually funny.
Does that always translate, though? Like, you know, you might have somebody who's obviously just sort of instinctually funny or unintentionally funny, but
right. No, it doesn't. But yeah, I just trusted that it would. And she's not, I mean,
she didn't really have the funny
role.
She
doesn't have the funny stuff. She kind of,
but
she kind of had a thankless part, but she killed it. I mean, she did so well, in my opinion.
But as I mean, you know, it's kind of cliche to say the straight man is as hard, if not harder, because your timing, it has to really be. Like, you don't get the audience laughing when you hit
right.
the mark. And there aren't those obvious, you know, responses that let you know that. So you really have to just be very good and trust
right.
your instincts as a straight person.
Right.
So, you know, working with
a couple of jackasses.
I guess that's the way.
Oh, yeah.
So this would be then definitely something that you want to do more of, right?
Absolutely.
Mean, that's great.
Yeah. I'd love to play bigger parts and, you know, happy in my place, but I was also very happy that this came about.
Well, you want to keep evolving, right?
You're, absolutely.
You know, who wants to just do the same thing anymore?
But I have, I have so many irons in the fire. I'm doing so many things at once that, you know, acting wasn't my focus, but, I'm more, stand up and writing and everything else and came together.
What else is coming up? I know you just have a lot of pride. Some things take, and then other things sort of spin kind of until they,
Just finished editing last night my new special. So, my new stand up special is called Criminally Posane, and that'll be on Amazon first and then kind of everywhere else after that.
I see. But, is that like an hour?
Yeah, it's an hour. It's my second. I did one, a couple years ago for Netflix, and this will wind up on Netflix, but we're starting out at Amazon.
Yeah, they seem to be just...
Everybody does them now, and it's cool to do them in these other places. I mean, HBO doesn't do too many a year.
Sure.
They're kind of... It doesn't mean what it used to mean to have an HBO special. You know, that used to be like,
if
you get an HBO special, it doesn't really mean that
prestige
anymore.
Prestige factor.
Now people, my peers do these specials wherever they want, Mm-hmm. So I was kind of inspired by guys like Louis and Aziz who... wind up doing them in different places.
And how long did it take for you to develop like this hour? I mean, I don't know when you did your last special.
So the turnaround for me is it's over 2 years. It's about, because I'm also doing other things, but I don't completely gut my act when I finish it. I'll start writing new jokes and then I'll rotate the old ones out and put new ones in. And then hopefully by 2 years, I have a full hour.
Right.
And that's kind of what happened this last time. The turnaround time is getting shorter for me. I think between my first record and my second record, it was 4 or 5 years, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Or about 4 of actually getting all the material. So I've cut that time in half. I'm down there like around 2. So
where did you perform that special?
This new one was in San Diego at the House of Blues during Comic-Con, which was a good fit.
Yeah, and people are already drunk and...
But they're also ready to hear a nerd talk about being nerdy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, that's what was so lovely about that character on Silverman, right? Because also on the Her Show, right? Weren't you? You were like the ultimate nerd, and
that character was basically me,
Was it tailored to you? I should say.
Yeah.
Because he was also a gay character, which was just sort of like in a way, it was a device. It was here's something you wouldn't expect. These two big kind of nerdy guys happened to also be.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a device, but
well,
it
I
was
mean,
kind of secondary to their characters.
Oh, for sure. And I feel like it was a really well played out. The characters were really well played out. I mean, it was
kind of the genius of Sarah. That was all her show. She ran it with other people, but I mean, all the ideas were hers. And Steve and I are two of her closest male friends in real life, and mm-hmm. she loves us and loves having us around, and completely wrote those characters for us. And honestly, we did the pilot, and it wasn't spelled out that we were gay.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did the second episode, and I'm reading the script, and I call Steve, and I go, "Hey, are we gay?" And he's like, "Are you an idiot?" And I'm like, "Yeah."
Which
sometimes
part, when you're waking up in the bed together, didn't you understand?
Yeah, it was kind of like,
"Well, you're both kind of big teddy bears, you know."
Yeah,
and it's nice. It was nice.
But I love that she did it that way instead of saying, "Hey, you're going to play a gay guy," and then it's
toss your arms around.
Yeah,
when
you know what I mean.
It was a very positive image, and it was, like you say, very secondary to the role. It didn't...
Right, and she didn't want... Not that Will and Grace was bad, but she didn't want the typical sitcom gay guy. That's not what she wanted from us.
Right.
You know, she wanted us to basically be ourselves, and then instead of being married to a tiny blonde lady like I am in real life, I'm married to a dude who looks like me.
Yeah. How old's your kid, by the way?
6.
Okay. That's nice. It's great.
It's a fun stage. I'm having a blast.
Yeah, I have an 11-year-old. It's still it's still fun. Yesterday, he took he got home from school on his own for the first time.
Oh wow!
Because a bad
That's
parent.
A big deal. Oh,
it
somebody
was.
Forgot him.
No, it wasn't quite like that. We had it like just his mother is an actress. And got caught up at some sort of thing she had to do. It was she had to do it. I was off doing something artsy too, and so. he and the babysitter was running late or something like that. So, you know, he knew how to get home, and he's almost 12. You know, he can do it. It's just that he ended up, and it was fine. It was perfectly fine without incident. I was just so proud. It's a big deal.
Yeah, 6 years for old, sure.
You can imagine, you know, one day him walking, your little boy walking, being old enough to kind of do that.
Right, it scares the shit out of me.
Yeah, a little bit, but I knew he was fine. Well, it was a lot of fun talking.
Yeah, man, nice talking to you.
Hopefully we'll do it again sometime with other films. Yeah, Uncle Nick is the name of the film, and it stars Brian Posehn et al., and it's opening, son of a bitch.
It's about 10 or 12 theaters this weekend.
It's opening Friday and around in city near you, and then I'm sure on digital platforms, too.
The same day. It goes to
iTunes,
Amazon,
all the big
Direct, I think PlayStation, all those places.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I mean,
thanks, man. Really, thanks for having me.
I hope it was not... I'm hoping it was up there, Marin... sure. Guy in, you know, Oshkosh.
I never do those. So, yeah. Nice.
I feel honored that you did it. It was a lot of fun
cool.
to talk to you. And,
thanks, man.
Thanks for listening to the podcast, everybody. This was episode number 325 already. I really appreciate your listening. And if you enjoyed this episode or any of the other episodes, please, please remember to go to the iTunes and to search FilmWax Radio in the iTunes store and subscribe if you're not currently a subscriber. Because, you know, you're walking around with your iPhone and you're walking around with your iPad. You have your Android or whatever it is you're listening to, give it a just download the show, you know, and subscribe to the show, and also give us this nice little star rating if you're on iTunes. For Pete's sake, and very few people are doing it. Not enough people are doing it, but you can also go to our Facebook page. We have a YouTube page. We have a Instagram page. We have a Twitter account. I mean, you can engage with the FilmWax Radio. We always get back. I mean, it may not be today. It may not be tomorrow. It might be, but it may not be. But it will be eventually. And if for a few weeks go by and you are, if there's something like that you're excited about, or there's something time sensitive, or get back in touch with me. Don't feel like you can't reach out to me. If you go to filmwaxradio.com, for instance, the website, you can, there's a link to, so you can email us. And I get your emails. And I will eventually reply to you. But if, for instance, if I don't reply right away, don't give up. I will. And if I don't in a timely manner, feel free to get, you know, stay on it. Because, you know, it's a one-man operation. I have a lot of stuff I do. And, you know, what can I tell you? I try my best. So there you go. Here we go. This is episode number 325 of the FilmWax Radio. Thank you for listening so much. Until next time, take it easy. Bye-bye.